Blog Talk Radio.
Now, in its second edition, Carol Dean's popular book, The Art of Film Funding, has 12 new chapters to cover all areas of film financing and how to avoid expensive pitfalls. Learn how to start with an idea and end with a trailer. How to make an ask for money. Create your story structure and your trailer. Legal advice, fair use, successful crowdfunding, how to ask for music rights, and what insurance you can't shoot without. Available on Amazon under Carol Dean and at FromTheHeartProductions.com. Welcome to The Art of Film Funding. I'm your co-host, Claire Papin, along with Carol Dean, author of the best-selling book, The Art of Film Funding. Carol is also the founder and president of From the Heart Productions and the host of this show. Our guests today are Suzanne Mitchell. She's the producer-director of Running Wild, the story of Dayton O'Hyde, and Helen Hall, producer and director of Pictures of Infinity. Our first interview is with Suzanne Mitchell, whose award-winning film is a cinematic adventure that examines the vibrant life of a cowboy, conservationist, and award-winning writer who, through extreme perseverance and enormous grace and wisdom, has preserved part of the American West for generations to come. Running Wild takes viewers back to lost times and forgotten places, giving them pause to reflect on their own contributions to this world. Congratulations, Suzanne, on winning the Roy Dean Spring Film Grant.
Thank you so much, and thank you guys for having me on the show.
Well, Suzanne, you were chosen over 100 other applicants, and From the Heart Productions, who host the Roy Dean Grants, thinks that you are a very talented filmmaker with an important historical documentary film. And we really appreciate this opportunity to find out more about you and the film. So, first of all, tell us how you found Dayton Hyde.
Well, first of all, let me thank you so much, because chosen from 100 applicants was like winning the lottery for me. And I just really, really appreciate it. And I remember I was out on a film shoot on a different project when I got the call to say that I was the winner. And I was jumping up and down and, you know, high-fiving my cinematographer. So again, it was a great experience to find out while I was on a shoot, not for this film, but for something else, that I had won, because I met Dayton Hyde 20 years ago. My film has been in production for 10 years, but I actually met him 20 years ago. I was contracted to do a People magazine special, their 20th anniversary special, and it was being created by Time Warner and being broadcast on ABC. And so the first assignment as the producer of that program was to go and read 20 years of People magazines and figure out what stories we were going to put into a two-hour special on ABC. And obviously we're all familiar with People, you know, tons of celebrity stories, and every now and then sort of that real person story, that amazing American. And I naturally gravitate more towards those in the magazine than even the celebrities. So I was hunting and pecking and figuring out, you know, how could we create a good mix for this two-hour special? And I came across a tiny little article with the story of Dayton O'Hyde. And he was standing in a photograph on a ranch, on the porch of a ranch house, and there were wild Mustangs, you know, in the backdrop. And it said, you know, Dayton Hyde is saving the American West and finding sanctuary for hundreds of wild horses that were being held captive. A story that I didn't even know about. I'm from New York. You know, the West to me is somewhere you go and you ski, and then you visit people in Los Angeles and then you fly home. I didn't even think about wild horses. And for no other reason than selfishly wanting to go out to what looked in that small photograph like the most magnificent place, I lobbied the executive producers of the special and said, here's what I want to do, you know, among the 20 other things I had to shoot for that special. And they said, hey, Mitch, go ahead and do it. You can go off and do that one. It does sound very visual. And again, I kept thinking, you know, how do we translate what's in a magazine, which is in print, into something that's visual and exciting for the screen? So we went out and we shot for 5 days out at Dayton's Horse Sanctuary in 1992. And he was living by himself on, at that time, 11,000 acres. Now it's 12,000 acres, in a tiny little, like, mobile trailer. And he was cooking steak in a little skillet, and, it, you know, it was a real rugged cowboy existence. And he was caring for these horses that he had rounded up and convinced the government to allow him to create a wild horse sanctuary. And just to back up a little bit, you know, the story of the wild horse in America starts, you know, way back. You know, they were the providers for the settlers. They were very, very integral to the Native Americans and the way that they moved and worked around this land. So wild horses have been here for years. Even though they're not indigenous, they've been here for years. And they breed excessively. And there are now no natural predators to control the herds, you know. So and development is widespread throughout the West. So their rangeland is constantly being reduced. We know about the global climate change. We know about the drought, even like the drought that we're experiencing this year out west. So the horses are finding it, you know, it's harder and harder for these wild horses to manage themselves on the land, on the public land. So Dayton said, he was out buying cattle out in the west for a ranch that he owned in Oregon. And he came across this feedlot of hundreds of horses being held in captivity by the Bureau of Land Management. Anti-slaughter laws went into effect in the early 70s. So the fact that the horses had no natural predators, no longer were they being slaughtered for meat to be sold overseas, they were exceeding their rangeland. And the government was also being lobbied very heavily by the beef industry and cattlemen to allow their cattle to graze on the public land. So there was a competition for the small supply of resources out in the West, you know, less grass, less water every year, more cattle. The cattle have a lobby. The horses didn't. So the government began to round them up and put them in these feedlots. And remember, there's an anti-slaughter law, so they couldn't be slaughtered. So basically you're taking a wild animal and you're putting him in a cage. And so when Dayton came across this, he was horrified. He said he just couldn't believe what he was seeing. And there was a dramatic turning point in his own life, and he had been a conservationist his entire life, and he felt like, well, this is my calling. And let me tell you, he was 62 years old when he saw those horses. Most people would be thinking about how they were going to retire. He was thinking how he was going to start a whole new life. So he decided to go to Washington and speak to different senators. Eventually, he caught the ear of Harry Reid and convinced Congress to allow him to create a private horse sanctuary and adopt the horses from the government feedlots. And that's how his story began. So when I found him in 92, it was already 88, 89, 90, about 4.5 years since those horses were first set free on his property. And he was still out there alone in this trailer caring for this immense piece of land. I mean, even before he could even set the horses free, he had to put up 50 miles of fence.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, to do that, you know, in your 20s is difficult, and this man was now in his 60s. So we wound up spending a week there just for this, what was going to be reduced down to a three-minute piece on a People magazine special that was going to air on ABC. And the reason we spent 5 days there, to get those majestic shots of the horses running, is not an easy task. First of all, it's not even easy to move around the property because there are many canyons. So just to get to where the horses are took, you know, half a day. And then once you got there, you needed to figure out a way that you could film so the horses wouldn't spook, because then you wouldn't get your shot. And to me, if we were going to do something that was, you know, visually, cinematically amazing, you know, I saw these horses running through, you know, through the frame. So we did that. And in doing and in having to create those shots, and it took 5 days, we spent so much time with Dayton. And he started telling us stories about his life as a cowboy, as an award-winning writer, as a man who basically went against the grain of all of his ranching neighbors back in the 50s and 60s when they were trying to get rid of coyotes on the land, he was making sure the coyotes thrived on his land. And it made enemies of you know, with his neighbors because of what he was doing. But he felt like there was a natural order to things, and there's an ecosystem, and there's a reason that, you know, ranches can survive and sustain themselves if you just maintain the natural order of things. If you start to mess with things, and we certainly have seen that in a lot of other environmental stories, then you're actually going to have a bigger problem down the road. So he told us that story. He told a story about Sandy, the sandhill crane. And he knew that there were only 14 left in western Oregon during the 1970s, and he's raising his family, had five kids. And he thought, boy, he was an observer of wildlife. You know, cowboys have a lot of time in the saddle, and they have a lot of time to observe wildlife out on the range. And he saw the sandhill cranes as, you know, they would lay two eggs, and then they would hatch two eggs, but suddenly one of the chicks would go missing. So he thought, well, if I could take one of those eggs and raise it in captivity and create a healthy flock, I might be able to save a bird that one day very well could be extinct. And he talks in the film about, you know, the Audubon Society and Fish and Wildlife folks calling him, you know, the worst man in American conservation for nest robbing. But actually they wound up really looking at some of the things he was doing, and it worked. And he actually wound up writing a book about it called Sandy, the Sandhill Crane, and that book did very well, as did a book about the coyote called Don Coyote. That book won the best of the 1980s literary award by the American Library Association. So he's telling me all of these stories in 92. And again, I'm thinking I have to make a 3-minute piece for an ABC special. Boy,
wow.
There's so much to this guy. He really deserves a film. So now I come back to New York, and at that time we were shooting on Betacam. You probably remember those days, right, Carol?
Right.
And we showed the footage to the executive producers, and the first thing they said to me was, who gave you permission to shoot on film? And I said, I didn't shoot on film. It's just that beautiful.
Oh, great.
And they said, wow. So cut to 1996. Here's where it gets a little funny. I am pregnant with my son, who's now 16, rather. And I was contracted by Barbara Koppel, 2-time Academy Award-winning director, to work on a special that she was directing called New Passages. And she brought me on as one of the producers on the project. And it was this special was about celebrating Gail Sheehy's book, New Passages, that basically in your 20s you do this, in your 30s you do this, your 40s, 50s, but the new part of New Passages, people who were from the World War II generation were now reinventing themselves. No longer were they at 65 laying down the gauntlet and saying, okay, I'm retiring, and, you know, I'm going to sit back and play golf the rest of my life. They were starting whole new careers. And so as one of 2 producers or 3 producers on the project, I was assigned to people in their 20s and 30s, and then the World War II generation. And so I said to Barbara, man, 4 years ago I met this guy named Dayton Hyde, and he's exactly what Gail talks about in her book. He, at 65 years old, started a whole new chapter of his life. He left his family in Oregon, his grown children, his wife, to start this wild horse sanctuary in South Dakota. South Dakota, because that's where he was able to find a piece of land that was suitable for the horses. I mean, if he could have found it in Oregon, he would have done it in Oregon, but South Dakota seemed like the right spot. And in the end, the piece of land that he saved was a piece of land worth saving, and I'll talk about that later. But
this is a magnificent story.
I know I'm going on and on, but basically we shot again for New Passages. We set up a shot of horses running. I was pregnant. He came over to me with 100 mares running straight at me and said, don't be scared. Just put your arms out, and they'll run down the ravine, and your cameraman will get the shot. And if you're 7 months pregnant and you have 100 mares running at you, you start to think, boy, I hope this cowboy's right. And he was, and they ran. Mm-hmm. And I said, wow. And he said, you going to name your kid after me? And I said, yeah, maybe if it's a boy. And so my son's middle name is Dayton.
Oh.
And when he turned 6, which was a year after September 11th in 2001, so 2002, I decided to take a pilgrimage and go back out to the Wild Horse Sanctuary so that Jack Dayton Howells, my son, could meet the man that he was named after. And at this point, Dayton was now in his 70s. And I said to myself, if I don't start this film, it's never going to get done, because I want to do it with him while he's still alive, not a retrospective piece, but a biographical piece that he can be part of. And Barbara Koppel, who I've remained friends with over the years, was so encouraging and said, you know, if you don't start it, you'll never finish. And then Dayton said to me some great words of advice. If you don't, I've never seen a hearse pulling a U-Haul full of stuff behind it before. And so I took the plunge.
Good for you. Good for you. Well, we're getting close to the middle of the show, and so could you just tell us in like 1 minute, fast,
yeah,
where you got your easiest funding, and give some other filmmakers an idea about the funding strategies you used?
I'm not going to recommend this, but my easiest funding was the equity loans that were available during the housing bubble. Okay, so my husband, you know, that was the, you got to, if you don't start it, you'll never finish. Okay, well, you know how hard it is to get funding. This was 2002. I knew television. I didn't know film. And so I just took the plunge and started taking loans out. But then, of course, I had to stop doing that because I was risking too much for my family. And then as the years went on, I sort of put it aside. And then just recently, last summer, the sanctuary called and said, are you ever going to finish this? Dayton is not getting any younger. And so a friend of mine was very gracious and allowed me the money to go out there and do the finishing. And now I had something in the can that I could create a trailer and a website with. And, of course, things had gone digital. You know, things changed a lot since 2002. I did not do the crowdfunding campaign, the Kickstarter campaign, because I was convinced that I could probably get private equity money by speaking to folks who had a passion for horses, a passion for film, and, you know, wanted to be part of an exciting project. And so I had a lot of meetings with a lot of folks that have money and who are business people, and I wound up working with Peter Broderick to put together a distribution plan, which I really needed. It's a, you know, the business plan for the film. And then eventually was introduced to some folks in England who have had quite great success with their telecom company, an internet telecom company, and they've put aside money every year so that they can invest in projects that are outside the scope of their own business. And so I was introduced to them through my husband, who's British, flew over to London, did a dog and pony show, and they came in for the back end so that I could get this finished. But I have to tell you, Carol, the grant is what's, you know, tying this whole thing together at the end. It was just sort of, it's just perfect. So thank you.
Oh, you're really welcome. And I know you needed Duart. I'm so glad that Carmen is there to take over and
yes,
help you.
Very,
that's going to be great. Well, thank you so much, Suzanne. You can stay on the show if you like and make any comments about Helen's film.
Great.
So, Claire, I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Right, yes. And I also want to thank you, Suzanne, and also let our listeners know the best place to find you would be at your website, runningwildfilm.com.
Correct. Thank
so,
you.
Yes, you're welcome. Now we want to introduce a finalist in the same Roy D. Grant, Helen Hall. Helen is a filmmaker and composer who explores an intuitive understanding of music as energy in her varied works for voices, instruments, electroacoustics, dance, theater, and film. Helen is currently working on a film, Pictures of Infinity, a feature documentary about Nikola Tesla's discovery that the Earth produces an unlimited reservoir of natural electricity and his invention that harnesses it, based on an entirely new understanding of science. Helen, I understand you were one of the 5 finalists in the spring Roy Dean Grant.
Yes, that's right. I'd first like to thank you and Carol for inviting me to be part of the show, and I was honored to be a finalist in the grant, and I'm really looking forward to my next application.
Yes, I have to tell you, Claire, that Helen has tenacity. This is one of the things that I love about her and other filmmakers. They never give up. She'll be back next year, I'm quite sure.
Yes.
And so, Helen, tell me about Nikola Tesla, because he's just getting into the consciousness. It's exploding with the Tesla car, the Tesla Museum to be built on Long Island, and your film about his greatest discovery. And I know his inventions are highly technical, so I wonder, how long have you been studying Tesla and working on this film?
Well, I've been actually researching the work of Nikola Tesla for more than 15 years now. I first came across references to him when I was working on my first film. I'm a composer, as you talked about earlier, and I was inspired to make a film. I'd never worked in film before, but I was kind of fascinated with the situation that we were in the early 90s, as we were sort of moving more and more into a global electronic culture. And I had worked in the early days back in the 80s with digital technology. I studied sound engineering and recording, and I also worked with computers. I studied computer music with a composer from Italy. This was, again, back in the early 1980s when the computers were mainframes. And at that time, this is going to get a little esoteric maybe, but I was studying something called tuning systems, and it's not easy to explain that or understand. And actually, as a music student, I also had been reading a lot about tuning systems, and we couldn't hear them. We couldn't hear what people were doing in ancient Greece or what the principles were. We could understand them maybe mathematically and in certain musical terms, but we didn't know what it sounded like. And because of computers, because of digital technology, which could take abstract concepts, numbers and ratios, and turn them into sound, it was actually the first time that that we were able to hear what was going on musically in ancient times and that sort of thing. And so there was just a huge explosion of research and innovation going on. And I had been, for some reason, I had been drawn into this subject and had been reading a lot about all the different things that were going on in music history, where they would one system would be used and that would they'd reject another system for different reasons. And their ideas about harmony, and harmony had to do not only with music but with the whole universe and what was considered, or what Suzanne, when she was talking about her film and the natural order of things, and this is really what people were thinking about, what was the natural order of things. And for the ancient Greeks, a lot of their knowledge about the universe and about everything, if you go back to Plato and Pythagoras, it was it came from a simple instrument called a monochord, which was a single string. And they took that string, and I think everyone can relate to this if they play a guitar or any kind of instrument, that if you take a string and you divide it into half and you'll have an octave, you'll have a sound that's twice as high or whatever. And if we had something to sound with, it would be very simple. Everyone would understand what we were talking about. But these are very simple principles. So a sound that's twice as high as you know, or half the length of the string, sounds twice as high, and it's a ratio of 2 to 1. And with these simple mathematical ratios, they sort of determined what everything in the universe was and what it was made of and how it worked and that sort of thing. It was all coming from the simple observations of a vibrating string. And so while I was studying my first inspiration, when I was working with computers and had this whole world of frequencies and ratios opened up for the first time, I really wanted to hear the Pythagorean tuning system. And it was just so exciting. But at the same time, I had an unusual experience with computers, and that was that I was very aware that it was affecting me in a strange way, that it was interfering with the electrical system of my body, and that's really hard to explain or talk about in simple terms, but just feeling extremely tired, migraines and that sort of thing. But also I could really hear a certain high frequency sound coming from the computer that I found very disturbing. And when I tried to speak to my colleagues about it, everyone of course thought that I was just being a Luddite and that I was technophobic. And of course nobody believed it because I was the only one who was hearing these things or experiencing these things. And so it was always something that really intrigued me because I thought, here we are studying, and also as musicians and composers, here we are studying what is harmonic and beautiful in the world and what is music as opposed to noise. And I thought, but what I'm experiencing from the computer on a physical level is like the worst form of noise, and it's not understood or accepted. Nobody talks about it, and I thought this is tuning. I mean, everything that we talk about is about what is in tune, but we're not talking about what isn't in tune. And on, I guess I'd have to say that would be considered an electromagnetic level because this form of energy is called electromagnetic. And so that was something that stayed with me for a long time, and that's when I started, I was working with digital technology, and I started sampling some of the sounds around me, the sounds of, you know, this is in the early 90s, so the sounds of computers, I don't know if people remember the sound that modems make when they're dialing up, and mm-hmm. The sound of fax machines, and all these sounds that we were being surrounded with at that time, and I started sampling them, and then I thought, you know, I'd really like to make a film, and but it started with the music, you know, so I had the music in my mind, and then I started extending it into images, and a big part of this was also that I wanted to research this paradox of this incredible technology and all these worlds that it's opening up for us and the way it's connecting us all over the world into a global electronic culture, but at the same time, how is this changing our environment, and how is it changing us, or how is it affecting us? So being electrically sensitive and having that not be understood was something I wanted to learn more about. And so,
absolutely, absolutely, Helen. And I just want to let you know we just have a couple of minutes left.
Oh,
so
okay.
Just giving you an opportunity to share more of what you need, and Carol too.
Yes.
Right. Know that Tesla worked with vibrations. He was all about that.
Yes. So I should probably link, you know, jump quickly into Tesla. So with the research that I was doing, I was in touch with a small group of scientists that are working independently, and they were all influenced by Tesla. Tesla was also electrically sensitive. He was the first person who I am aware of to have publicly or whatever have been had done experiments to explore both the healthful and the harmful effects of electromagnetic radiation. And so this is the person who invented alternating current electricity, but he was also extremely electrically sensitive. So he was very aware of the adverse effects of radiation on the body, of artificial radiation, and he was very committed to working within natural principles and within the natural order of things.
Wonderful. All right. Well, I know that you've gotten some funding. Could you just tell us the names of the places that support your project?
I started, just to say quickly, I was working on my first film, and with the first film I got support from our national film institution called the National Film Board of Canada. And when I was working on this film, I was speaking to them about it at the time, and there was a lot of interest in this subject. But at the same time, the government was cutting back very, very much at this time, and so everything changed on that level. And so it was you know, probably 2 or 3 years. And then I got funding from a small government organization called the Canadian Independent Film and Video Fund.
Hey, well, and I think Claire has to close for us. Thank you so much.
Oh, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you both so much. You can find Suzanne Mitchell at runningwildfilm.com and Helen at picturesofinfinity.net. Carol and I want to thank you for tuning in. Please visit us at our website at fromtheheartproductions.com. Good luck with your films, everyone.